Good morning again. The court calls the case of Center for Constitutional Rights versus United States. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Thank you. Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the court, my name is Shana Kavadal, and I represent CCR and various media groups who are petitioner appellants in this matter, along with Jay Dixon, who is seated at council table. With permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. It goes without saying that the court-martial of Private First Class Bradley Manning is a matter of exceptional public interest, yet not a single one of the trial court's orders has been published by the trial court. None of the government's briefs have been produced, despite the fact that many of the motions to which they relate...
Counsel, how do we have jurisdiction over this matter?
Under the All Writs Act?
No, the All Writs Act isn't an independent source of jurisdiction, as you know. It's only an aid to jurisdiction. How under our statutes, how under Article 67, do we have jurisdiction over this matter?
Right. I think we cited Donato and I'm forgetting the other case in our in the jurisdictional section of our opening brief.
But Counsel, Donato was very clear. It didn't expand our jurisdiction and didn't expand the reach of the All Writs Act. It was concerned with the writ of quorum nobis. Right.
Right. Well, our position has been that the First Amendment applies to military courts in the same way that...
And I'm not suggesting that it doesn't, Counsel, but we have a threshold issue here, which is we're an Article I court, which means that we're a court of limited jurisdiction, meaning that our jurisdiction is limited to the statute and, under the All Writs Act, something in aid of jurisdiction under the statute. And the statute's fairly precise and limited as to what we might do. And so... Even if all of your arguments were, persuasive and we agree with you 100%, it doesn't give us authority to act. Do you understand
sure.
what I'm saying?
The statutory limit here may well be, as we've argued in our papers, Article 36 of the UCMJ. So Article 36 states that the rules for procedures in courts martial have to, as much as practical, they should follow those that are applicable in criminal trials.
That's not an independent source of jurisdiction.
Article 67 is our statutory basis for jurisdiction. Are you not prepared to discuss this? Because I don't want to waste your time if you're not prepared to discuss it.
Right. It certainly wasn't challenged by the government, as far as I recall in their briefs.
So you don't disagree that courts always have authority and the necessity to examine their own jurisdiction.
Subject matter jurisdiction is non-waivable. I would suggest that perhaps this is a matter for some supplemental briefing.
Are you familiar with the De Victoria case?
I am not.
Okay. You're at a disadvantage if you're not familiar with the De Victoria case. It was a 3-2 case at this court, and that is reflective, without characterizing the opinion, which should speak for itself, it is reflective of the fact that there are differing views as to the nature of this court's jurisdiction. It's a jurisdictional case. It would be hard to be in your position and argue jurisdiction without being familiar with that case.
You should probably also look at the Supreme Court's case in Clinton versus Goldsmith.
Has this court ever addressed a question of public access to a court martial?
Having received this question about the basic subject matter jurisdiction, I'm not sure that it has. I recall that we did brief the Denver Post case.
Let me ask you a leading question. Are you familiar with the case of Hershey or ABC?
Right. Mm-hmm. Certainly the leading CAF cases on openness of court proceedings.
And are you prepared today to discuss how they do or do not apply to this case with respect to not just the substance of the outcome, perhaps, but also the threshold of jurisdiction?
The threshold jurisdictional question wasn't raised by the government, so I haven't looked at that closely in preparing.
And when you look at the ABC case and the Hershey case, you should also consider the fact that they were both decided 2 years before, or the latter was decided 2 years before Clinton versus Goldsmith, where the Supreme Court took this court very much to task on our expansive overreaching in the jurisdictional area.
Okay.
But again, the point is not to make an argument to you here. You're supposed to make an argument to us.
Certainly.
So why don't we proceed on the basis that you've received a number of questions with respect to the threshold jurisdiction, and are you requesting the opportunity to provide supplemental briefing?
I would.
Is there any objection to that occurring in this case?
No.
And so we'll put some appropriate time limit on it. How much time do you think you would need to so do?
I think the sooner the better.
Be careful what you ask for. can you step out of the courtroom for a moment, please, and come back in? How much time?
I believe we took about 4 business days to file this this appeal from the denial of relief in the ACCA. So maybe something like 10 days would be appropriate for me.
Government, do you have any objection to 10 days? And how much time would you need to respond?
I'm prepared to respond.
So you would not care to respond to their filings?
No, I wouldn't. I would say 5 days is fine.
Is there any objection? Does that seem fair to everybody up here?
Okay, perfect.
So that's so ordered or granted or whatever we do in such a case.
As I was saying, none of the government's briefs have been produced by the trial court below, despite the fact that many of the motions to which they relate have subsequently been argued in open court. The defense briefs are only available at the grace of defense counsel.
Counsel, what is the nature, if any, of the press's right to access to otherwise open court proceedings? Does it differ in kind or extent from the general public's right to observe court proceedings?
Generally, the Supreme Court and the federal courts have been hesitant to draw any distinction between members of the public and the press. So in Brandsburg, there are these very expansive statements about how duties that, basically how the court is hesitant to create a special exemption for providing evidence for members of the press because that would require the court to distinguish between citizen journalists and mainstream journalists and so forth. So I think as far as public access cases go, the courts have generally not wanted.
So what you're really vindicating here or trying to vindicate is basically a general public right of access.
To the documents, yes.
Well, then, don't you have a standing problem then? Because you're coming up here and trying to vindicate a right that's the general public's. How is there injury in fact to your clients that isn't shared by the public at large? And if you're trying to vindicate the public interest, don't you run into a Frothingham v. Mellon taxpayer suit kind of thing?
The Supreme Court has obviously taken issue with what it calls generalized grievances underlying standing, but by the same token, it has frequently said that the fact that an injury is widely shared doesn't mean that individual plaintiffs don't have standing.
I think you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
Here.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a generalized public interest, then your clients haven't suffered an injury in fact that isn't shared by the public at large.
Right, but there's, I don't think the other sort of prudential concerns about standing, the desire to have parties who have, enough of an interest to zealously advocate for their side of the story in court, they really apply here. And so the court has recognized standing when it is broadly shared.
In this particular case, the clients that you represent have requested documents that have been, those requests have been denied, correct?
Right.
And that's what you're complaining about.
Right. Not all of the clients, but certainly CCR and the individuals we represented at the time we submitted our letter, and for the others, I think it would have been futile for them to request it given the court's order on April 20th.
You're reacting to a specific ruling of the military judge. Is that correct?
Right. The one that was produced to this court on April 3rd.
Do you have any case law? I mean, if you put your complaints into 2 different areas. One has to do with documents that already exist that you've been denied, correct?
Right.
And then the other falls in, is with reference to the 802 conferences, and those are documents that don't exist that you would like to have created. Do you have any authority from a federal court or from the Supreme Court requiring a court to create documents to give to you that otherwise would not exist?
Not directly, but I think the open access principles really have to apply here. And I think one way of thinking about this is looking at Rule 806B and Rule 802, Rule 802B allows for waiver, essentially, of the right of the public's right of access to what's discussed in 802, right? So it says that substantive matters may be argued by consent of the parties in an 802, and they should be memorialized on the public record, but that if the parties agree, if a party fails to object to the lack of memorialization, then that waives any right that might have existed. If you look at the public access rule 806B, the discussion note there indicates very clearly, consistent with the First Amendment, that the public access rights are rights of the public as well as the parties, and they can't simply be waived away. I think when you boil down our argument about the 802 conferences, it really kind of comes down to this. We believe that the parties ought not to be able to argue substantive issues behind closed doors and then by consent waive away the public's right to know the substance of the legal arguments that are made and the factual positions that are taken.
But your answer to my initial question, which is, do you have authority for any court for a court being required to create documents that didn't already exist under the First Amendment, you don't have authority for that.
Well,
direct authority.
Sure. I mean, I think, if there had been a case that was conducted entirely behind closed doors and nothing had been transcribed from the proceedings in that case, if that was challenged and that went up to the federal appeals
court. What about informal discussions that judges sometimes have with counsel where they say, counsel, come back to my chambers, and then they're not memorialized? Do you have any authority for a case where the press asked to have that discussion memorialized on
Right. I would break down the kind of relief that we would we'd ask for here into a couple different categories. So, if the typical use of an 802 conference or any sort of phone conference like the ones that you mentioned that happen in federal court all the time is to do scheduling or other routine administrative matters. There'll be some order that pretty much memorializes everything that needs to be said. You know, here's the schedule that was arrived at. Maybe if one party vehemently objected for some reason, you'd want to see that recorded. Often a minute order would say something about that. But by and large, there aren't going to be controversies there. Now, bench conferences are a different story. Those usually take place during trials. And the reason to have those conferences, whispered or in chambers, is because you want to keep them out of earshot of the jury, right? So, keeping a jury from being contaminated by hearing discussions that might prejudice them, that's obviously a compelling interest
But you don't know why the 802 conferences are having it. I'm just putting your requests into different categories, all right? And you have a lot of legal support for one category, but paucity of legal support for the other category. And it seems to me that there's a difference in kind and a difference in strength of an argument that that things need to be created that otherwise would not exist because of your desire to know them, as opposed to your desire to have things that already exist that are being withheld for you for reasons that you say are not good enough.
Right. Well, I think, to go back to my hypothetical of a proceeding where nothing was transcribed and everything was closed to the public, the remedy that I think any federal court would order there on appeal is to redo the proceeding.
But you're not suggesting that that's what's happening. You're talking about limited 802 conferences, and you're not suggesting that you're being denied access to the case itself, to the trial itself.
Well, we don't know how much has been decided here, and I think the reason for the paucity of ordinary federal court authority here is that the 802 process is relatively unique.
Counsel, I don't know if you did litigation in private practice, but you don't disagree that there's a lot of things that happen on the telephone with counsel from both sides on the telephone with the judge, right? That happens all the time.
Yes, and there's extensive consent motion practice in federal courts, right? But, there you've got the one party coming in and saying the other side consents to the relief that I want, but they do spell out the arguments for why the court ought to enter that, including typically some explanation why the relief is within the court's power, why it's not against public policy, and so forth.
Counsel,
and all that gets on the public record.
If we were to assume that nothing substantive is supposed to occur in that 802, that there's supposed to be administrative procedural, and if that in fact was the case, why then wouldn't a summary on the record of what occurred satisfy you? And what I'm saying is that there is some assurances there that nothing substantive had happened during that.
Sure. And, the rule states that substantive matters can be discussed, right? And if there were an adequate summary, I think that would be okay. The problem is the defense below has complained, and we included his brief describing this in the joint appendix at page 32, has complained that the summaries have been inadequate. And, in fact, that the government has made factual representations during those substantive arguments in an 802 conference that they have later contradicted.
Has the defense joined up here? They were given the opportunity to weigh in. Did they weigh in?
The defense hasn't submitted an amicus brief, if that's what you're referring to. But
did afford them the opportunity to do so, did it not?
I'm sorry, which court?
This court's order did open that door to them, did it not?
Certainly. I suppose the response brief's in mid-April. I would just say this to that. One of the major themes of our briefing has been that some of the risk here is a collusive risk, the risk that both sides may agree that things should be kept off the record. If you look at the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on access to courts, first you've got the Gannett case based on a Sixth Amendment right that is personal to defendants. That case comes down in 1979. A year later, the Supreme Court is forced to extend under the First Amendment the right of public access to the general public and the press. In part because of this notion that, especially in the sex abuse trials that Richmond newspapers, Globe, that many of them are in that series, deal with sexual abuse of minors. In those cases, there may be a joint interest between the parties in keeping things off the public record, right? So the prosecutors don't want the court proceedings to be open because the minor witness may have difficulty testifying and so forth, a compelling interest. The defendants don't want the evidence out there because it destroys their reputation before they're even convicted. Right?
Could I note that you're out of time, but you can have as much time as you need to answer questions so long as there are questions, and if the government needs the additional time as well, we will grant it to them. Did you get to finish your thought before I rudely interrupted you?
On which subject?
Whatever you just said.
Okay. I think I've said what I need to say about the collusive risk.
Start with the right of your argument starts with the right of public access. Is that correct?
Right.
And then the first bridge you have to get over, putting aside jurisdiction and standing, is to what extent is that right coterminous with papers? Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in your brief, you say that every circuit that has ruled on this matter has stated that it is coterminous or it includes in some manner publicly. How would you characterize
it? It includes in some manner documents. I think it's safe to say we include parentheticals in that footnote 5 in our opening brief that note which types of documents the courts have extended access to. There's a definitional question. How far should that extend? What kinds of documents are there documents that fall outside it? I don't think that this court needs to answer that because necessarily for the relief we've asked for, because the briefs, the orders, the transcripts, or equivalents, I think are clearly covered by what all the circuits would consider to be what we've called judicial documents. We borrowed that term from the earlier common law cases, and the definition is basically, it's in our briefs, it says things that are relevant to the performance of the judicial
function. Do you believe that the right, whatever the right is a qualified right? Clearly, Press Enterprise and all the cases refer to it as a qualified right. Is that correct?
Sure. I think the First Amendment, the fact that strict scrutiny applies to this access right doesn't mean that it's fatal, in fact, for the government.
Are you here arguing that you have a public right of public access to classified information?
We included a footnote in our opening brief that noted that Mr. Dixon and myself have top secret clearances on reflection.
That's not my question, though. I'm very happy for your clearance, but is your argument that there is a right of public access to classified information?
I would think that it properly classified information, meaning that it properly meets the definitions in the relevant executive orders, that it's not classified for purposes of concealing misconduct or embarrassing information, that would surely satisfy strict scrutiny.
Nice, simple response.
Do you have a reason to believe that there's a conspiracy for people to collude and conspire to keep information from you? Because those words keep on coming up in your arguments.
Right. Certainly not a specific theory.
The suggestion that, that as long as it's properly classified and wasn't done so for purposes of keeping it from us.
Right. Well, that's
a discussion about the 802s as though somehow the government and the defendant in this case are colluding at the 802 conferences to keep information from you. I just wondered if there was some basis for your use of
nothing specific, and I think of those as two separate issues. I think the issue about
I just wanted to clarify for our record.
Sure. Nothing specific. I think like most people who have had some experience with the classification system, my own perception is that there is massive overclassification of information in the federal
system. I have some additional questions because I think when we get onto the classification system, we might be here for a while.
I think your answer to my question was no, and that's fine.
Chief Judge, I have just one question.
Okay.
If I may. I'm familiar, having practiced extensively in the federal district courts and so forth, with the availability of documents through a PACER system, online, et cetera. Are you aware of any similar system in military courts martials, which are ad hoc devices? Who's in charge of the records of those? Who would produce them? Who would pay for them? How would you go about structuring it? Isn't FOIA a perfect vehicle to get that done?
Right. FOIA isn't a perfect vehicle for the reasons that we spelled out.
FOIA could be a perfect vehicle if somebody did it quick, right?
Well, if there weren't inbuilt exemptions that have already operated in this case to effectively deny media requesters access. So okay. Josh Gerstein requests in early 2011, when the issue of Private Manning's mistreatment in detention is a matter of international concern, including but from the UN Special Rapporteur, he requests the defense's motions.
Can you focus on this in response to Judge Cox's question?
Sure. In terms of expense and technical burden,
is the process that you would forecast? The government has suggested that FOIA is the process. You obviously take an issue with that. But in light of the who has custody and control of the documents, so Judge Cox's question in part is directed to how would your process play out in the context where the military judge may or may not have actual control and custody over the documents? That's a question. Another question is, how does this get heard or handled? Let's say, as a general matter, there's a qualified right of public access to the trial as well as to certain materials. How do you forecast that would play out? Are you sitting there in the front row, jumping up? Or what is the process that should be involved here, et cetera?
To answer that question first, as we've said in our briefs, the default presumption is openness, which ought to mean that there's some system where one doesn't have to make a tremendously burdensome kind of request. This court puts the briefs up on its own website. My understanding is that despite the ad hoc nature of trial courts in the military system, that most submissions are now made by email. I think in terms of technical burdens, one doesn't have to create a PACER system in order to have electronic access, and frankly, electronic access itself may not be mandated under all conditions. Before there was electricity, I believe members of the media probably accessed judicial records by simply being allowed to copy, to examine and copy them.
Have you asked the parties for copies of the orders and filings?
David Coons, the defense counsel, puts them up on his website.
So you have access to those?
To his, although they are heavily redacted. And when I say redacted, they're not redacted for classification reasons. The government doesn't believe...
What I'm asking is, have you asked the government counsel or defendant's counsel for copies of the judicial orders and filings made in the case? Have you made that request to them?
We have CC'd our two request letters to the court.
That's a different question. That's a different question. Have you asked the government directly, can we please have copies of this?
I'd want to take a look while the government is up here at our letters, but I don't believe that the answer to your question is yes in terms of a direct request. But okay. They are certainly aware of our requests, and they certainly
object. But
you'd
agree that that's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Have you made the request to the convening authority?
I believe the convening authority is also, meaning the Military District of Washington, also CC'd on our initial
request. So they're aware that you've asked the military judge, but you've never asked them.
I think that's, well, you know, depending
on... You want to check. I understand you want to check, but your initial response is no. And in terms of...
Right, they're certainly aware of their requests.
When you request something through FOIA, you don't CC the agency head, do you? Is that the proper mechanism for requesting?
Well, typically, I think the party that receives, the agency within the government that receives a request ends up forwarding it. So one of our plaintiffs actually did make a FOIA request for the very bit of the trial judge's order that was produced to this court on August 3rd. They haven't received a response more than 2 months later, except to note, to be told that their request had been forwarded to two different offices. So I'm not sure that the government is quite sure.
And also,
the actual custodian.
Your particular argument here, then, to be perfectly clear, because you can't be up here arguing that before our court that you're complaining about someone didn't respond to something that was CC'd to them. Surely not. Your specific argument is focused on the judge's ruling reflected on page 19.
Right.
Of the record. Is that correct?
Right. And I think our contemporaneous access arguments would probably mandate that the trial court exercise control over its records.
And also, I guess, when you talk about contemporaneous, unless things have changed dramatically, you understand that it may not be the case that there are transcripts created every day as there is perhaps in the federal district court.
Right. Actually,
are you suggesting then that, again, and this falls into the people being required to create things that otherwise would not be created in the time that you would want them?
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, it may not be the case that there is a physical transcript in a military court. And I don't know. I don't know how things happen now. But it might not happen until well after the trial is over.
Unfortunately, I don't know either. Having attended one day of sessions and having asked a number of people
Would you agree that your argument is somewhat weakened if you're asking them to create something more quickly than they otherwise might of something that you can be present and hear?
Right. Well, they are either taking that sort of recording, which sometimes I think is through a dictaphone, sometimes through microphones, or they're having a stenographer put it together.
But so that doesn't mean that it's physically being created in a medium that can be handed over to you, and you're not suggesting. And I guess my question about the transcripts is, why must you be able to copy the transcript if you can physically be present in the courtroom and listen to what's going on just as well as the person who's taking down the notes?
Right. I would just say that that's, I think, overly burdensome.
And who would bear the expense of preparing a copy of the transcript and giving it to you? Would it be you or would it be the government?
I think the ordinary federal practice, although in the federal government the stenographer is kind of a private party.
Right. I mean, right? It's a private stenographer that will pay anyone who wants a copy.
Right.
And the person who wants a copy would pay the stenographer.
Right. So anyone who wants it typically is paying the cost there, right? I think one option here, if there isn't stenography happening in the courtroom, and again, we're not sure what the practice is that the audio files can simply be uploaded, which again, I believe is a practice in this court. This court hasn't created a PACER system, but for all practical purposes, the record of the arguments here is available online. That's a very simple mechanism. A lot of federal courts do it too. The Supreme Court releases digital audio the second counsel walk out of the courtroom. If we do have a stenographer in the courtroom, then the typical practice nowadays is for that 10-key keyboard to be connected to a computer that transcribes everything into words.
And again, I don't have a factual basis to know what they do.
Right. Unfortunately, I don't either in terms of what's happening at the actual trial court. It was a little bit too difficult to see that far up in the room. But either way, I think there's some digital mechanism for providing some either transcript or the equivalent, which is the audio files.
Do you agree that if they're not already, that if they aren't already created, or if it's not happening the way that you hope that it might, that it comes closer to looking like the 802 conference, that you're asking for something that doesn't already exist quicker than it might otherwise be provided? And I'm just asking, would you concede that that's different than getting something that is physically present and exists? I mean,
Again, I would think that the remedy there is, unfortunately, that the proceeding might be invalidated. I mean, with respect to the 802s,
present in the courtroom. You're able to have public access to what's happening. And I guess I'm just asking you, how does that translate into a right to have a transcript created contemporaneously that might not otherwise exist when you physically have public access to what's happening?
Right. I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very practical question. It's just, I think, too burdensome on the members of the...
It's too burdensome on you. This is a general court martial. The rules require a verbatim record. There will be a verbatim record.
Because, I mean, you're coming up here on an extraordinary writ, right? And you're asking us for something that's extraordinary. Do you see what I'm saying? And in the case of some of the things, it sounds like you haven't explored all the options. And in the case of this other thing, and we're not even sure whether it exists.
Right. Well, you know, as an initial matter, I think, you know, the trial judge here doesn't think that she has an obligation to make these things available in any form. You know, as we said repeatedly, I think in our briefs, I think it would be enough for this court to simply say that the First Amendment right of access to documents applies to the trial court here as it does in every district court in the United States. And then at that point, the technical details of these kind of accommodations.
That's pushing it a little. Because that's supposing that there is a there's a First Amendment right to contemporaneous access to documents, which I'm not sure exists in the court martial context.
Well, you know, again, I think we've cited a lot of authority for the idea that this exists, that it's been recognized even specifically with respect to the First Amendment right of access to documents. I believe we've cited three different federal cases. We also cite a long line of public access cases going back to Oliver, the Supreme Court case from the 1940s, where first in the due process context, then the
Well, a lot of those cases deal with the denial of documents altogether.
Certainly, a lot of the cases
We're not talking about that. You're going to get, there's going to be a verbatim, assuming this trial ever goes to conclusion, there's going to be a verbatim record of trial because the rules and the statute require it.
May I ask you?
Isn't that?
But there's no way to get it.
Well, yeah, what I'm saying is, isn't that enough, and if not, why?
I would say that the why is simply that the requirement for contemporaneous access is linked to the ultimate rationales for allowing public access to begin with, which are not just about fairness and
well, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not being held under the magic hood, you know, it's not being held in a skiff somewhere.
Sure.
You can sit there, your artist can sketch people, you can take notes, you can do everything everybody else can do.
Judge Cox, do you have any other questions? You were cut off. Any other questions from the bench? You'll have some sort of opportunity on your minus 11 minutes of rebuttal time.
Very good. Thank you.
Counsel for the government, please.
Counsel, before you start, if the petitioner asks you for copies of judicial orders and filings that are not classified, is there any reason that you wouldn't give them to them?
Well, Your Honor, I think this case is not necessarily about whether or not you give them to them, but what the process is by which you obtain those.
I asked you a very specific question. If they write you a letter and say, "Dear government, we would like copies of the filings and orders in this case. Will you please give them to us? And yes, we will pay you for the copying costs."
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer...
And it's not classified material.
I think the answer in that scenario, Your Honor, is that request needs to be made to the proper person. They can't just walk up to
Sergeant
Smith. Who
is the proper person?
The proper person...
You are representing the government, so is this someone who's not in the government?
No, Your Honor. The Army, by regulation, has defined who the proper person is, and it's the Office of the Judge Advocate General, and you can obtain that person's name and phone number freely online. So, again, the question is... If you were to hand a request to Sergeant Smith saying, "Can I have these documents?" and Sergeant Smith says, "I'm not the right person," you haven't been denied anything. You just haven't asked the right person for these documents.
What would happen then if that request were made to the Judge Advocate General?
I mean, you're here representing the government, so fine. They asked the right person. Can we please have copies of this document? What would the answer be?
Well, Your Honor, I think it has to be a document-by-document analysis. There's no blanket.
Okay, let's start with briefs. Is there, what... First, does the government accept that there is a public right or first in right to public access to a court martial?
To the proceedings, Your Honor, or the documents?
Proceedings.
To the proceedings, yes. I think this court has said that there is the right to a public trial applies to court martial
and documents.
Okay, now let's make the bridge to documents.
Well, Your Honor, I think that based on the research, the Supreme Court has not addressed that question. The circuits have, and it's not unanimous. Now, I know I cited to the court back in the case, there's a split within the Sixth Circuit. That case has not been overruled.
So the appellant is incorrect that all the circuits that have addressed the link to records have cited that there is a link to records?
No, there is a link to records, Your Honor. I would agree with that. But the
Hinge... Okay, so we're just now going to pick a record, briefs.
Sure.
What is the government's view on whether there is a public right to access briefs that are unclassified?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that those fall within the FOIA, which they do, the public has a right to access those documents.
But counsel, I mean, I'm a simple person from the Midwest, right? And here we are making a big to-do about something that in most jurisdictions, the stuff is available online, and they can just go and get it. For whatever reason, the stuff is not available online within your particular, within the military. Why can't you just give it to them?
Well, Your Honor, because Congress has said this is the process that we're going to follow. So
Congress
it's not
has overruled the First Amendment right to a public trial through FOIA and said, wasn't the whole idea behind Press Enterprise is that the open prophylactic process of a fair trial? And if you put it into the FOIA context, how does that work? 6 years later, you get access to it when it's been processed?
Well, Your Honor, Press Enterprise was about access to the proceedings, and all of the Supreme Court cases have been about access to the proceedings and not access to the documents. These are executive branch documents.
But I'm asking you a more simple thing, right, which is instead of making a constitutional case out of this, why don't you just be reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, this is not about what the executive branch is doing. This Congress has decided that this is the process that you will follow,
no,
the public will follow when they want access to court martial.
Has Congress decided that it's the exclusive process?
Do they say that no person may ever give a brief or put it? Because I mean, I guess we're violating the law if we put our if we put the briefs online.
No,
because no one
all.
Asked about through about the, for access to them through FOIA.
Not at all. FOIA says that the government can affirmatively make some of this information available.
And so my question is, why doesn't the government affirmatively make classified information affirmatively available that already exists? I'm not talking about creating things that don't already exist. I'm not talking about rushing your transcript process or creating things that don't normally exist. I'm talking about things that actually already exist. Instead of making a constitutional, you know, issue of it, why don't you just make it available?
Sure, Your Honor, because I think, well, again, first of all,
and that has nothing
sure
to do
yes
with,
or sure what?
Sure, I will answer.
You know, and that has nothing to do with, you know, threshold questions of jurisdiction or standing or any of that. That just has a common sense question, which maybe I'm not supposed to ask, but I'm going to.
No, it's fine, Your Honor. And I think the problem with that argument is that what is
it's not an argument; it's a question.
With that question is what does relief look like? Who is going to do the redactions in that case? There's been this, you know, in this particular case in the record, we know there's been a substantial amount of information exchanged pursuant to protective orders. Who is going to redact that information?
Can we start just focus on the briefs, try and take something fairly
sure.
It's fairly focused.
Yes, sir. So if there were
has the court not established the court martial not established a process of review and redaction?
Yes, they have, Your Honor. I think for the defense briefs that the defense wishes to post online. Absolutely. I think the court has put in place a system to do that, but that's again very finite. And
why would not that system work for the government's pleadings and briefs?
I think it could, Your Honor, but I don't think that the military judge needs to undermine or subvert the statute. Congress has said if you want access to the government briefs, there's a process by which you do it, and there are people
who work. Is that really what FOIA says?
Yes, Your Honor. I think
notwithstanding Press Enterprise, notwithstanding any other court case in the First Amendment right to a public trial or 806, FOIA is the exclusive mechanism by which you have access to court documents?
I think that's what it says, Your Honor, because none of those Supreme Court cases addressed any documents that were subject to FOIA.
Does FOIA purport to be exclusive on its face?
Your Honor, I'd have to double-check the statute, but I think the way the statute reads, it is the mechanism by which the public has access to documents. And I
it is a mechanism.
No, Your Honor, I think it is the mechanism.
Okay, let me ask you another question. What is a court martial? Is a court martial a court, or is it a creature of the executive?
It's a creature of the executive, Your Honor, but you know it's hybrid in many ways, and it has many of the features.
Does FOIA apply to courts martial during their existence? Certainly, the record of trial ends up after it's authenticated in the hands of the executive, namely the TJAG or his agents. But does FOIA apply to courts martial during their ad hoc existence?
Absolutely, Your Honor, it does. There is no exception in the statute. There's no temporal.
Well, in other words, what I'm saying is that a court martial is only a creature of the executive and is not part of the judiciary.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. That's fine. Honest answer.
So
they can go through FOIA while a court-martial's going on.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the Army regulation specifically says that. It says, if you want court-martial documents, here is the office that you direct that request to. And I think the temporal nature of it, Your Honor, is really, I think the temporal
nature... Has there been a request made in this case by the appellant present in this courtroom?
I don't think there has been. There's no evidence in the record that there's been a FOIA
request. Did you say to them, you're asking the wrong person, it's not the military judge, you should do it this way?
I didn't, Your Honor. The military judge did. The military judge said, I direct you, I know the existence of FOIA, and that I am not the custodian of the record, and you need to direct your request properly. So,
counsel, is there any prohibition in FOIA with the judge advocate general establishing a different procedure?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's actually permitted. I think that FOIA allows...
In other words, if the trial judge or the convening authority or the judge advocate general said, in this particular case, there's keen public interest and to facilitate the First Amendment rights and the Sixth Amendment rights of the accused and so forth, let's release these orders contemporaneously. There was no prohibition in FOIA to do that.
I don't think that there is, Your Honor, no. I think that could be done, but it's not constitutionally required,
Back to my first question, which is there's what's constitutionally required or not constitutionally required, and you both can quibble about that all day long, and there's what's simple and reasonable. And I'm just asking you, if it's something that does not create additional work other than putting something on a website or providing copies at petitioner's expense, you know, why wouldn't you just do it?
But
you don't disagree that this is a case that has great public interest.
No, not at all, Your Honor. I would disagree with that. But my point, I disagree with the proposition that there's no burdens imposed. I would say practically, what does the relief look like? Who does the redactions for protective orders? Who does the redactions for privacy?
Are you suggesting that there aren't redacted copies of all these things that are in existence already? Because surely some things have to be provided. Copies of things are provided to people that don't have clearances. So doesn't the government already have a redaction process in place? I would expect that they would.
I would expect that they do for perhaps classified information, Your Honor. But we're talking about exemptions additional exemptions past classified information. But I think to address...
But you don't know.
I mean, no, it's not on the record, Your Honor. No, I don't want to speculate.
So you don't know, but you could find out, right?
I could find out, absolutely, Your Honor. And I think if this court, to come back to your jurisdictional questions that you made to appellant's counsel, to the extent that there's a jurisdictional issue, I think it's a standing problem. And to get to Judge Stuckey's point, it's a standing problem, I guess, yes, because the injury to, if there is an injury, it would be shared by many. But I think our argument
The injury that they're complaining about is an injury specific to themselves, which is they asked the military judge for something and he said, no, go to FOIA, he or she.
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's been an injury in this case, because I think when the military judge says, I'm not the right person to release these documents because the code says the trial counsel is responsible, that is not a denial of access. That is no different than Sergeant Smith saying, I'm the wrong person. The military judge does not control the record of trial. The trial counsel, pursuant to RCM 808, is responsible for producing the record of trial. So when the judge says, you need to go to the proper person, that is not a denial of anything.
Counsel, do you agree with the allegation of the appellants in this case that the commission proceedings in Guantanamo provide greater access to the documents than your proceeding does in this case?
Well, I would think the fact that, you know, the military commissions has their website, and I think that the pleadings are posted online fairly quickly.
And I guess my point there is that if they can do it, why can't you?
But, Your Honor, the question is not whether or not the government can do it. The question is whether or not the Constitution requires it.
Well, no, and I guess that gets back to Judge Ryan's question. Do you only do things that the Constitution requires and not do things that common sense would compel?
Whether it's constitutionally required or not. Different issues.
What you're doing here is by taking this position, you're forcing a court, either this court or some other court, to make a First Amendment ruling that you may not like.
I understand that, Your Honor. I don't think that this court has jurisdiction to say that. And the reason I say that is because there has been no First Amendment infringement.
Well, let's assume that we don't have jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
But someone does. Okay? So, go back to answering the question, which is, why don't you just come up with something reasonable? You know, do you know whether transcripts are created in a contemporaneous manner of court proceedings?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, obviously, but I think as a general matter, it would make sense not to do that because Article 54 says the type of transcript that's required depends on the verdict in the sentence. So I would think it would not make sense to waste a lot of resources, which are finite, on producing a transcript that may never be required.
May I ask you a legal question?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
Having dispensed with common sense, was it... I'm struck by the fact that neither the military judge nor the government cited to ABC, Hershey, or the Army CCA Court of Scott. Was it not error for the military judge not to cite to those three cases and to address, among other things, the language in Hershey that states, which the present court may or may not agree with, but it is in the Hershey court, when an accused is entitled to a public hearing, the press enjoys the same right and has standing to complain if access is denied. Now, that's access, not records. But I don't understand how you can appear before this court, said with respect, or the military judge can rule on this case based on 806 and not cite to Scott, Hershey, or ABC. Is it the government's view they're completely irrelevant?
I think that ABC is not applicable in this case, Your Honor. And here's the analogy I would draw. It would be as if in ABC, the media filed a writ requesting that this court, before any closure occurred, keep the proceedings open solely because RCM 405 allows them to be closed.
Okay.
There has been no denial of access.
Well,
and
counsel, in those cases, what was being denied was actual access, right?
To the proceedings.
To the proceedings.
Yes, sir.
Physical access,
yes, sir,
to the proceedings because they were closed in whole or in part for reasons that this court deemed not important enough.
Yes, sir.
But they don't address documents.
No, they don't. They don't. And again, I think that's why the military judge was not required to let the parties intervene either, because there has been no closure. The military judge made very clear on the transcript that the proceedings have been open. So there's no requirement to allow the public to argue or to present evidence or to present argument at the motions hearing. There's been no closure. If there were a closure or if there were the sealing of a document, then I think it would be required.
So it's not ripe.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's
it's
what we
not, have to this do. Is not ripe.
Exactly. And to carry that one step further, Your Honor, I think ripeness suggests that if something were to happen, then the appellant could be back here.
What's the difference between sealing a document and not providing a document?
Well, Your Honor, I think the effect is the same, but the rationale behind the two is completely different. Completely different. When you seal a document, you are saying the public cannot have access to this document for X, Y, and Z reasons.
And if you don't give it to them, you're saying you can't have access to this document, period.
For no reason, because you don't want to give it to them.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. Nobody has said you cannot have access. Factually, in this case, nobody has said you cannot have access to these documents as a factual matter. But second, I think that this court needs to defer to Congress in terms of the Congress set a 20-day window for what they deem to be a reasonable amount of time for the government to review information before it is released to the public.
But counsel, you're going to have to concede that there's nothing in FOIA that prohibits you from being more expeditious.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And there's nothing in FOIA that prohibits an agency, including the Office of the Judge Advocate General, from providing an alternate mechanism.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Absolutely. Absolutely. But to get back to the point...
To get back to the law.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. To go back to your point, Judge Stuckey, about ripeness. Again, I think ripeness suggests that if a certain event were to happen, then we could end up right back here. But I don't think we could end up back here because the only entity or person authorized to withhold these documents from the appellants is the Office of the Judge Advocate General. And if the Office of the Judge Advocate General says these documents are withheld for whatever reason under FOIA, that decision is not reviewable in this court for two reasons. Number one, Congress has said Article 3 district courts are the place to resolve that. And number two, it's not within this court's statutory jurisdiction to review administrative agency decisions.
Is it within this court's jurisdiction if the military judge were to close the trial outright?
I think so, Your Honor.
So under 806, this court would have jurisdiction to review a military judge's ruling under 806 to close public access to the trial.
I think so, and that would be kind of by extension Hershey and ABC versus Powell. But
well, it would be the Sixth Amendment right if the accused to have an open hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, and it could be both. It could be First and Sixth Amendment, I guess, depending on whether the accused objected or maybe it was the accused requesting that the court...
Because ultimately that impacts the findings and sentence, right?
Ultimately, yes, Your Honor, I think it does. Now,
the validity.
I understand EBC predates Goldman.
What is public access if you don't have access to what's being argued? It'd be like attending oral argument, but not having, I mean, I don't know what one would make of this oral argument, but if one didn't have the briefs, you'd have a pretty uncertain idea of what was going on.
Well, Your Honor, it's not as if they're speaking a foreign language in the court. I mean, I understand the argument, I understand the point, but, you know, there has been no denial of access to the proceedings themselves. And I think what appellant is requesting that they have these motions and these briefs before the parties actually argue it in court. And I just don't see how that is constitutionally required. I understand how the federal system does it.
What's wrong with the public having copies of the briefs?
Absolutely nothing, Your Honor. And I think the way the PACER system is implemented is fantastic. But I don't think that PACER is constitutionally required.
So from a practical perspective, you don't see anything wrong with giving these documents to the appellants and the public, but you don't have to, so you're not going to.
No, Your Honor, I don't. That's not how I would say it. I think that, again, if you want to look at this, you have to look at this document by document. We cannot make a blanket, all the briefs are available. Because they're not, because there are certain subjects.
Obviously, they're going to be redacted to some degree.
Sure.
I mean, and I think everybody recognizes that.
I mean, what happens a lot of time, counsel, is that if instead of fighting about things at this court or in an appellate court, when counsel sit down and talk to each other, they can come up with reasonable compromises that make both sides not fully happy, but somewhat happy.
Your Honor, I understand that point.
Which is not constitutionally required.
I understand that point, Your Honor, but the appellants have argued that they have been denied access to these documents, and the court has granted that issue. And I think the government's position is that there is no jurisdiction to hear that because they have a standing problem. Nothing has been withheld. And if they were to have documents withheld, then the proper place to resolve that is in
order. Well, wait a minute. I thought you were arguing ripeness. I thought you were saying the controversy is ripe for adjudication because there's been no denial.
I think.
Are you saying instead that they've suffered no injury in fact because there's no denial?
That's right.
Or are you saying both or neither?
No, I'm saying it's a standing problem because there's no injury in fact because they have not been denied access to these documents. Certainly.
So you're not arguing ripeness?
No, and I'm not arguing ripeness again, Your Honor, for that point because
it's not ripe either. If they're right for the same reason that there's no standing, it can be the same thing.
Yes, Your Honor, but again.
And I'm not saying there is no standing, but for the reason that you said that there's no standing.
Yes, but, and like I was saying, you know, I think ripeness suggests that we could end up back here if a certain condition were to occur, and I don't think that's possible.
But what you're saying is it's not possible because of the way the statute is.
That's correct. That's correct.
Counsel, just a quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Had Judge Lynn ordered the trial counsel to provide copies of the briefs and her orders and daily transcripts, did she have the authority and power to do that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it would be no different if this court were to do it. I think that you cannot do that without completely vitiating the FOIA. Congress said this is the way that it will be done.
And to whom would you appeal that?
That's a good question. I'm not necessarily sure that we would, but I mean, as far as the legal question, as far as whether or not she has authority to do it.
I think you're obligated to answer the question. If you say the military judge does not have the authority to control the documents and evidence presented in her court, then who does?
Your Honor, I think that
so control she, of the So record. She orders the briefs produced, and who do you appeal to?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that we would appeal that because I think that
the question is who would you appeal to?
If you wanted
whether
to.
I don't know if I'm prepared to answer that.
Who has the authority to direct the military judge in the context of a court-martial?
Well,
is the government taking the view that a convening authority could so direct the military judge?
No, I mean, I think it would have to be within a military court to the extent that a military judge exceeds her sphere of discretionary power.
You would seek a writ of prohibition?
Probably, Your Honor. I mean,
saying that she needed, that she was the wrong person.
Yes, I mean, essentially the same argument that we're making here.
All right. Are there any questions up here? You're entitled to more time as a matter of fairness. You're not required to take it because the Constitution is not so compelled.
I'll read the tea leaves on that, Your Honor. Pending any further questions from the court.
Fair enough.
There's a lot to respond to there, but let me start with the question that was left hanging. My co-counsel informs me that we did ask defense counsel, Mr. Coombs, for copies of the government's briefs, and he told us that he didn't feel that he had the power to turn those over to us, which is consistent with, I think, everything that happened in the trial court.
So would you agree that defense counsel, under anybody's reading of the law, is not the custodian of the government's document?
Certainly.
Okay.
I think, Chief Judge Baker, you answered the first point, or made the first point that I was going to make getting back up here, which is that as a practical matter, and I can speak from experience on this because I was in court on the 23rd, it's almost impossible to understand what's happening, even with access to the courtroom, if you can't read the briefs ahead of time, and if you don't know what previous orders the motions are responding to from the judge. You know, the defense made this argument in their briefs that they made up here just now, which is that no, the court has an order that you can't have access. No, there is no order prohibiting us from getting these things. And I would analogize to, you know, what if this courthouse happened to be locked when everyone showed up to get into the audience, and the judges did nothing to make the courtroom open. I don't think anyone would accept that under the existing First Amendment law, right? As to FOIA, Your Honor, you asked what courts martial are. I think they're both executive branch agencies subject to FOIA, that's clear, but they're also courts, and for that reason the Sixth Amendment right of open access applies to them. I think we ought to interpret the First Amendment in the same way, applying via Article 36. If we think that FOIA, which was designed to open up government to the light of day, was somehow designed to shrink access to these proceedings, then we have to figure out what the, you know, whether or not Article 36, which is also a statute of Congress, contradicts the FOIA statute in this respect. I would just draw another analogy. What if Congress were to pass a law saying, essentially, we extend FOIA to the records of the judicial branch? I think FOIA wasn't extended to judicial branch records at the outset because federal courts are thought to have an inherent control over their own records. But I don't see any reason why Congress couldn't try to create a parallel system. But does anyone think that the existence of FOIA exemptions and the inbuilt delays in FOIA would somehow operate then in the court's interpretations to shrink the right of access to judicial records? I certainly.
Well, you know, the scope of a ruling that you may be asking us to make, to me, is unforeseen, because I think for years the clerk of the court of the Army Court, for example, is if you want to see the Cali case, to use an example, you have to make a FOIA request. You can't just walk in there and get a copy of the transcript and the orders and everything, can you? I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's the way they do business, isn't it?
Right, right. Well, this case is the one that's at issue.
So I don't know how to. As I understand it, what you want us to rule is that under the First Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Article 36, RCM 806, the public, including the press, has a reasonable right to obtain copies of briefs, orders, transcripts, and other documents, unclassified documents related to the trial.
Right, and that right is more urgent when proceedings are going on. Again, the contemporaneous access point, and I didn't get to make this final point earlier, it's not just about fairness and the appearance of fairness, it's about accuracy. And the Supreme Court has said this over and over again, that unknown witnesses can emerge, that there's a disincentive to perjury, that the press can fact-check the factual assertions. And in fact,
but that all has to do with physical witness testimony, a lot of those things.
Well, I think it has to do with factual representations made in legal arguments. We haven't had witness testimony below, but we've had a lot of factual argumentation, and the defense has complained about inconsistent factual positions. There are legal issues too, right? These are always factors. The courts perform better in their function of arriving at the truth when there is contemporaneous access by the press and public.
Counsel, one of the problems that I foresee with the breadth of your request is, what happens next? You know, if we don't require you to go through FOIA where there's a mechanism for appeal, every time you don't agree with the document being classified or redaction and you want to know more, you get us involved or try to get us involved. That's problematic.
I think what we've asked for from this court, both on the document access issue and the 802 issue, is a simple statement that the First Amendment applies. And I think the trial court here, frankly, is begging for that statement. It's clear from her academic scholarship that she believes that it doesn't yet, and that she believes that that's a problem. I think all this court needs to do is say that and let the lower courts work out the details. Again, I think once that's clear.
You are going to explain to us how we have authority to do that under our jurisdictional statute?
Certainly. Once that's clear, I think the technical details.
And also in light of FOIA. And also in light of FOIA and its mechanisms.
Certainly, certainly. But again, I think, you know, we've spelled this out very well in our briefs. I think the main problem is that that FOIA simply doesn't allow for the sort of contemporaneous access and doesn't allow the scope of access either. So again, those 2011 requests by the media for the defense motions around the conditions of confinement, every one of the motions was denied to the press. Under various FOIA exemptions, which we've laid out in our briefs. And I should say that one petitioner did make a FOIA request. On August 3rd, Kevin Gostola, who's one of our named petitioners, and I can submit this as an additional authority, made a request seeking the very order of Judge Lind that this court ordered to be produced and that the government produced on that same day. And 2 months later, he hasn't received it, and it seems unclear whether or not the government knows who the actual FOIA release authority or custodian is.
Counsel, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is what I would propose, that we've asked you a couple of questions on jurisdiction and on standing, but rather than speculate and guess what those questions might be, we will issue an order to you indicating the questions we would anticipate that you would address in your supplemental briefing. At that point, when you receive the order, we'll then put into the 10 days and 5 day response times. Is that a fair way to proceed?
I think that'll work.
Is that agreeable up here?
Yeah.
Because I think there's too many questions floating about and too much fluff to get, and we need to get focused on what the core issues are. So we will issue an order. Of course, we will not impose a time limit ourselves to issue the order, but we'll try to do that in as timely a manner as possible. And you are, of course, as always, free to file anything in a supplementary manner that you wish to do in the interim. Is that agreeable to both sides here? Okay. Well, we thank the parties for their arguments, and the case is now under consideration, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.